Virginia Tech and UVA took two big steps back on the football field, but their basketball programs gave us reason for optimism in their openers. We'll talk about that and much, much more on another jam-packed edition of Teal and Barber. Welcome to episode 124 of Teal and Barber, our Virginia Tech, UVA, and ACC sports podcast. You can subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your favorite pods. I'm Mike Barber, ACC beat writer for the Richmond Times-Dispatch, and joining me as always, my co-host, the 14-time Sports Writer of the Year and the Virginia Sports Hall of Famer, Mr. David Teal.
Mike, did you enjoy getting back to covering sports indoors this week?
That was a welcome change, although I'll be honest, it's 80 degrees here today, David, in Charlottesville.
Oh, wow.
It's beautiful. There's no wind. I spent much of the day playing pickleball. I know you and I talked off air. I also spent much of the day doing some home repair work at my parents' place, but I got to enjoy the weather a little bit, got out and got to play pickleball for a couple hours. So, yeah, it's certainly that wonderful time of year where the leaves fall and basketball overlaps and football, and just ignore the temperature gauge. That's the only part that throws things off right now.
Indeed.
David, let's jump right into it because we got a ton to get to. It is a great time of year and there is so much going on. Let's start on the football field where Virginia Tech, you and I both felt like had maybe turned the corner. We thought that they could go to Louisville and maybe play their way into the ACC championship game race. Instead, David, things did not go that way.
They did not, Mike. From the first snap, when Kyron Drones was buried for a 10-yard sack on a busted protection, and I'm here to tell you, Louisville is good, as in real good. And I believe that Louisville is better than Florida State defensively. Now, I think Florida State, if it gets Johnny Wilson and Keon Coleman back healthy, it's two top wideouts. I think the Noles offense and Louisville's defense, that could be a hell of an ACC championship game. And that is certainly where it's trending. Florida State's already clinched a spot. Louisville is close to doing the same. And yeah, the Hokies did take a step back, but against the second best team in the league, clearly, and on the road.
Okay, so I agree with everything you just said, and I'm not trying to nitpick, but that was a beat-up version of Louisville that the Hokies got. That wasn't even full-strength Louisville, so it kind of goes to your point about maybe how good they could be. I mean, Jawar Jordan, the running back, was limited. Thrash, their top big play receiver, did not play at all, if I'm not mistaken. They had some guys out on defense. I believe they had a starter out on the offensive line. I don't know their long-term prognosis, but based on 34-3 over the Hokies, yeah, I think this Louisville team looks great. It begs the question, how did they suffer that loss they suffered?
At Pitt. Yeah. Well, and that was a game, Mike, where Jordan only carried the ball twice for like 8 yards before injuring his hamstring. Now, I don't know how limited he was Saturday. I mean, he touched the ball on 8 of the first 10 snaps of the game, and it looked like they were going to wear him out. And then they bring in the Wisconsin transfer, Isaac Garendo. I mean, he proceeds to just gash the Hokies. And that offensive line is really good, anchored by Brian Hudson at center, the Virginia Tech transfer, what they wouldn't give to have him still in the program. But Tech was more competitive in Tallahassee than it was in Louisville. And to me, that's the discouraging part of it.
So that's going to be the big question. It's the big question for when we talk about Virginia as well. Did you see an off night, or did the Hokies, is that step back something that, where do they go from here? Because you and I were both kind of feeling like, wow, they've, not that they're going to light the world on fire, but hey, they've really found an identity, both running and passing. The line was playing better. The defense with its pass rush was dominating games. Daquan Felton becoming a big play guy. Bashal Tootin, his explosiveness, what Drones has done to transform that offense. Can they just pick up where they left off with the good stuff? Or did you see problems there that maybe have been kind of re-exposed for the Hokies?
We'll find out Saturday at Boston College. Let's remember, Mike, Virginia Tech hasn't beaten anyone that matters. Not anyone. They've beaten Old Dominion, Wake, Syracuse, and Pitt. those are not very good teams. I mean, Old Dominion might be the best of the four. I mean, Old Dominion had Wake beat in Norfolk and then kind of gave it away late. But it's hardly murderer's row there. BC, to me, seems more like a fair fight. Yes, the Eagles have won five straight. But again, who have they beaten? They've beaten Syracuse, UConn, Georgia Tech, Army, and UVA. Again, hardly an inspiring bunch. So I'm really interested to see what goes down Saturday at Chestnut Hill.
Yeah, you know, Boston College is on fire. NC State is fascinating with the move of their quarterback opting to sit out the rest of the year and preserve his eligibility. We assume Morris is going to head to the transfer portal, it would seem.
No, that's the interesting part, Mike. His dad says that he's staying in NC State, that he doesn't intend to transfer, which is really bizarre.
I just don't see how that plays out that way, though, David. I mean, you're essentially saying, I don't think we're any good this year. I'm quitting on this year's team to preserve my year. I don't see how you're comfortably back in that locker room. It doesn't add up to me. It doesn't add up to me for the other guys in that locker room. Are they playing or are they giving up? That NC State to me is not in a good way, a fascinating story the rest of the way. Can Brennan Armstrong kind of resurrect his career in the final few games and maybe change his legacy there? It's that story to me could be its own podcast, David. I think that's just a bizarre circumstance.
It is. But it brings Brennan Armstrong to Lane Stadium in a central role in a week and a half. And won't that be interesting? Where he, depending on the results of Virginia Tech at Boston College, he could put a fork in the Hokies' bowl hopes.
Yeah, which is just wild. And, you know, the Hokies, you talked about, they haven't really beaten anybody good. And here's the good news. They don't really play anybody good the rest of the way. I know the Eagles have won a bunch in a row, but
yeah,
you just mentioned, NC State and then Virginia. You know, granted, it's a rivalry game. We haven't seen these coaches against each other. But, you know, that is a schedule that midway through the year, once we realized NC State wasn't any good, I would have looked at that stretch and said, geez, Tech could win all three of those. I don't think they will. I still think they could win any and all of those games. So, David, let me ask you this. We used to do take it or leave it on the show. Take it or leave it. The Hokies win enough down the stretch to make a bowl game.
I'm going to leave it. I don't have – number one, I haven't seen them win on the road yet. I mean, they've been two different teams. Now, part of it is based on competition. I get it. But they've been far different at home than on the road. If they win Saturday, I really like their chances. If they lose Saturday, I really don't like their chances. And I have no feel for how Saturday's going to go.
I'm with you 100%. I think it is a must-win game for bowl eligibility. Again, you're talking about winning six games and being bowl eligible, so it's not exactly a high accomplishment there, but I think they absolutely, it's a pivotal one they have to have. And you don't know what you're going to get from Boston College. You don't know what you're going to get from NC State. You don't know what you're going to get from UVA. But David, bigger problem, I don't think you know what you're going to get from Virginia Tech.
No, you don't. And, you know, it was interesting listening to Brent Pry afterward. They had more big time issues with busted run coverages, but these in Pry's mind weren't a matter of, okay, you weren't in the right place in the right gap. This was a matter of you couldn't shed blocks, that Louisville just lined up and dominated you. And part of me thinks that's a bigger concern than not being in the right gap, because Boston College's O-line, now that Christian Mahogany is back after missing last season with the knee, that's a pretty stout offensive line and has produced some rushing yardage. And Castellanos, the quarterback, is very elusive. It's going to be fascinating. You know, Mike, we kind of look at the transitive power of sports, and it can be so misleading. Boston College damn near beat Florida State. And Florida State was far superior to Virginia Tech. But the Hokies boat raced Syracuse. You and I were both there. And I don't know if you subjected yourself Friday night to Syracuse Boston College.
Indeed, I did.
Right. So did I, which speaks to our lives and, or lack thereof. But Boston College was lucky to win that game. So, again, I am so confused about what happened Saturday in Chestnut Hill.
Yeah, it is bizarre. And, David, Boston College only beat Virginia by three. So, it's the transitive property, it doesn't work when you're talking about a bunch of bad teams playing each other. You just can't use it anymore. We saw Louisville absolutely dominate Virginia Tech. Now we see Louisville on Thursday night host Virginia. David, Virginia's coming off, I think, their worst performance under Tony Elliott. I think their most, David, discouraging performance, because everything was pointed the right direction.
Agreed.
Right? This team beat William & Mary, upset North Carolina, took Miami to overtime. It really felt like, okay, I'm, you know, not that they're heading for the college football playoff here, but this team has figured it out. They're going to play good football. Win or lose, they're going to be competitive. And David, they were not competitive at all against Georgia Tech.
Mike, I thought they were going to win the game.
Yeah, I did too.
And I came home from Louisville Sunday and popped on the DVR. And I knew the result, but I was like, dang. How many yards did Georgia Tech rush for?
Georgia Tech ran for 305 yards and 5 touchdowns. They had 3 touchdown runs of over 30 yards in the game.
Right.
And that was from a defense that had been, again, it's about competitive. They had been competitive. And we talked on this show, Drake May missed some throws in the Carolina game that might have made that a different story. But overall, Virginia did the things leading into this game that it needed to be competitive. And it did not do that on Saturday. And, of course, there was the whole quarterback situation.
Yes.
We're going to get into that here. So they start with Tony Musket, who is their guy, on the final play of the first possession. He stands in. I've said this a few times now. Tony Musket's injury, he went out on brand because he stood in the pocket. He took a shot. He delivered a ball downfield that was a chance, a 50-50 ball for Malachi Fields, but it's just the luck they've had. It's picked off. He takes a big-time shot, ends up with a high ankle sprain. He's in that medical tent, right? David, they've got the tent up. You can't see what's going on, but the coaches have got runners getting information. And the first thing they're hearing is he might be able to come back. So they go with the walk-on, Grady Brosterhaus, for 3 or 4 snaps, and then comes the word, he ain't coming back today. And they burn the red shirt on Anthony Calandria, which had always been the plan. If Musket was out for an extended time, Calandria plays. If not, you try to get through. David, they went with Calandria. He wasn't great. He looked rusty. He looked like a guy who maybe thought he'd been redshirting. what do you make of that situation going forward?
Well, I don't think they had any choice. I mean, you play to win, and Calandria gave them the best chance to win once Musket went down. So I don't blame them, and I don't think Anthony Calandria resents, you know, having his red shirt year taken away. And I think a red shirt is a possibility next season, presuming Musket comes back and they bring in a quarterback or two via National Signing Day or the portal. I don't know the severity of Musket's injury. I don't think either of us does, but it's a high ankle sprain, right?
Yeah.
And they're tricky, and this is a short week.
I
expect to see Calandria tomorrow night in Louisville.
Yeah, I think it makes no sense to rush Musket back when you've already burned the red shirt for Calandria. You've got the short week. You've got probably the least winnable game remaining on your schedule, though Virginia's schedule is not favorable for them. To me, it would be crazy and then malpractice to rush Musket back. They're listing him day to day, and I'm sure at the end they'll call him a game time decision. But my expectation is we'll see Calandria. My expectation is Calandria will be better this game than he was against Georgia Tech because he'll be more prepared, those kind of things. But David, it's not a good situation any way you slice it.
No. And aside from Tennessee, maybe even including Tennessee, this is the best team Virginia's faced all year.
Yeah, and perfect timing. And so what is the feel then, David? Because like I said, the vibe was really positive. They beat William and Mary, and we said, okay, you did some good things, but it's an FCS opponent. Then they went into the open date. They came out. They beat Carolina, a game they played very well, probably the best game they've played under Tony Elliott. They go to Miami, and yeah, they made some mistakes there that they could have won that game. They lose it in overtime, but competitive with Miami team that's been very up and down. And then the Georgia Tech, they just lay an egg. So what is kind of your view of this team as they go down the stretch?
What did Tony Elliott say after the Carolina game? He said, the job is to prove this was not a, using his phrase, one-off. Thus far, it looks like a one-off. And that's on him and his staff and his team. Tomorrow night looks grim. I'd be... not stunned, but very surprised if the Cavaliers went to Louisville and won. But the next two, Duke is, yes, Duke 6-3, and Mike Elko may be doing a better coaching job this season than he did last season. But as anyone who saw the Duke-Wake Forest game the other night realizes, Duke without Riley Leonard is very limited on the offensive side. And Virginia Tech is no world beaters, and you're getting both games at home. Tomorrow night is Virginia's final road test. So to me, any verdict on Virginia's season is going to be based in large measure on those last two games.
Yeah, I think that's fair. And you mentioned the coaching, and it was interesting because Georgia Tech hit Virginia on what to the untrained eye looked like the same play a lot of times. It was that inside handoff on third down. And John Rudzinski and Aaron Famui basically told us, hey, they were anticipating third and five passes, right, and they kept getting hit by runs. So they were in the wrong gaps. They were in the wrong defense over and over. John Rudzinski said he got his tail handed to him is the way he described it. And, this team isn't good enough to have the coaches be off, right? The coaches have to be, and maybe it's pressure or whatever, but they've got to be dialed in. They've got to be on their game to give this team a chance. That is one area where I think maybe more than the Virginia Tech to Louisville loss, you can maybe put this one behind you because, this team wasn't in the right places. The quarterback injury, it was very disjointed. In a sense, I think it will be easier for Virginia to recapture their good feeling than Virginia Tech. But I think the problem with that statement for me is I don't think Virginia is as good. So right. I think that's the, yes, there's some reasons that Georgia Tech got sideways on them that I think are easier to move on from and correct. At the end of the day, Virginia's just not that good a football team. And, that schedule that's remaining, I don't love it. And I don't know. So my question, since I asked you, do you think Tech gets to a bowl game? Do you think Virginia finds another win this season? I went into the year, I thought they'd win three games. They're sitting on two. David, do you think the Cavaliers have another win in them this year?
No, I don't. Man, I am really pessimistic today, Mike. I didn't realize until you started peppering me with questions, man. Here I am saying, the Virginia Tech's not going to make a bowl. Virginia's going to finish 2-10. Whew, it's rough.
You're the Grim Reaper. Here's the reason I'm asking you these questions. You're right, and I didn't want to be the one. I didn't want to be the one to say it, but yeah, I'm inclined to agree with you. I think Virginia Tech finishes 5-7. I think that UVA doesn't win another game this year. So it is bleak, and it's a shame because 2 weeks ago we were on this pod really feeling like those programs had some positive momentum. And again, would that equal three more wins or something? Who knows? But it just felt like there was a good vibe around both, and that has faded. David, though, there is a good vibe, maybe a great vibe, around both these schools' basketball programs. I thought both of them, yes, they opened against weak opponents. They won convincingly, yada, yada, yada. But there were things in both games that I was really encouraged by. Looking at UVA, their win over Tarleton State, looking at Virginia Tech, their absolute blowout of Coppin. There were things when you dive into those games that made me say, hey, these teams look like they may be all right. Let's start with the Hokies And I'll tell you my number one, and there's a lot of good things about what Mike Young's club did, but the play of Lynn Kidd.
Lynn Kidd, I knew you were going there.
That's a game changer and a program changer for me. Not that he's going to be a double-double guy in, you know, ACC competition, but if he is a guy that can have that kind of an upside, I think that really changes the outlook for this team.
Agreed. Because you know, or you think you know, that even with you know the departure of late of Rodney Rice to well, we don't know where he's going. We presume he's going to Maryland, but his departure from the program, Virginia Tech is going to be okay on the perimeter. The question is in the interior, and if, like you said, if they can get consistent production from Lynn Kidd, then it is absolutely a game changer for this squad.
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting because he's sort of been an under the radar guy, but Mike Young's been pretty high on him for a couple of years now, right? Like, yes. This isn't—it's not a surprise to Mike Young, and in fact, I think it would be more of a surprise slash disappointment if Kidd didn't take another step in his game. But when you have that, you know, inside-out element, which with Couture and Padula, if Kidd can be effective inside, you're going to have that. It is a game changer, and David, it's also a game changer for them defensively, because I thought at times last year their effort was there defensively. And their breakdowns, it just didn't feel like if teams got past that first level and got to the rim, it felt sometimes like it was going to end well for them and not well for the Hokies. And I think Lynn Kidd can be a game changer in that regard too, whether it's shot blocking, rim protecting, just being a body in there that you don't want to dribble into, defensive rebounds. I think he makes a difference on both ends of the floor.
As gifted a scorer as Grant Basile could be. Mm-hmm. He was a liability on the other end, big time.
Yeah.
And your point about defensive work in the paint is well taken. And that's where they need to really shore it up. Although, as Mike Young did not shy away from during preseason, folks like Sean Padula got to be better defensively as well.
Yeah, it's interesting his kind of outlook and take on Padula, who's it's so much fun to watch, needs to be better defensively, needs to take better care of the basketball in key moments, mm-hmm. and not take bad shots in key moments. And I like the way Mike said it, because it was, hey, it's okay to turn the ball over and it's okay to take bad shots, because that's part of Sean Padula's game. He's ultra aggressive. He plays with that flair, but it's about the moment, right? It's about pulling up and missing a bad shot when your team's up by 12 or on a run, okay. But if the other team's chipping away, are you feeding into their momentum with your turnover, with your bad shot? And just, you know, it's a thing that point guards, I mean, guys are just born with sometimes, and sometimes it's hard to coach into a guy, but that feel for the game, right? When to attack, when to slow down, when to push it, when not to. When can you afford to take a chance? When will a chance be potentially a dagger on the other team versus when are you leaving the door open? And it's going to be really interesting because Padula scored 15 points. He hit 3 3-pointers in the opener. He had 10 assists and 2 turnovers. That's good, man. That's really good for a guy who plays the way, the pace and the style he plays. Can he do that against other competition? Because I think the points are going to be there. And I know he took 11 shots, but you know, he's not Allen Iverson. He's not that kind of volume shooter, but he's got a guy who's going to take a lot of shots. He's going to miss some. He's going to take some ill-advised ones in there. But if he can be 10-2 on the assist to turnover in big games against big competition, that's going to bode really well for this team.
It will, and we'll find out a lot more about both squads with a little one-stop shopping Friday night in Charlotte when the Hokies take on the Gamecocks and the Cavaliers take on the Gators.
Yeah, it's going to be really interesting because it's almost, and there's no preseason, you know, for us anyway, because a lot of the scrimmages are private, secret, top secret, classified scrimmages. I know some schools played their charity exhibitions, but Coppin State, in a sense, was a preseason game. South Carolina is going to be the real deal. Huge step up in competition. And exactly what we just talked about is what I'm looking for. Is Lynn Kidd, maybe not statistically as effective, but as effective against South Carolina's front court? Is Sean Padula as composed with the basketball, as good in the assist to turnover ratio? And then the other thing is Tyler Nickel, the transfer from North Carolina. I think he opened some eyes with his talent and what he can be. It'll be interesting to see him against South Carolina, because he played a little bit for the Tar Heels a year ago. So he is an established young guy.
They love Tyler Nickel, Mike.
They should. They should.
All of them, to a man, say he is as pure a shot as you will see. One of those where every time he lets it go, you think it's going in. We'll see.
We will. It's going to be fun. It's going to be fun to watch Virginia up the ante a little bit here when they play Florida in Charlotte. Now, Virginia dismantled Tarleton State 80-50. Tarleton State is a transitioning program out of the WAC. They're actually coached by Billy Gillespie, the old Kentucky and Texas A&M coach. Billy has played in his 4 years a lot of big-time Power 5 opponents and has generally kept it close. So the fact that this was a 30-point blowout, maybe a good sign for Virginia. The really good signs for me were how versatile their lineups can be. And I wrote about that a little bit in today's paper. But, you know, Reese Beekman and Dante Harris, two point guards, they played them
together.
Yeah, they played them together, David, four times for 10 minutes. And they outscored Tarleton, I think it was 26-10 in that time they were together. So they look good on the floor together. Defensively, they are stifling. They're both long. Dante Harris is, and this is a, I know, a big statement, but Tony Bennett has echoed this. He's as good an on-ball defender and as disruptive as Kia Clark. And I think he's a better athlete because he's longer, rangier. He's better on the offensive end. Again, will he have the career, a five-year run that Kia had? We'll see. But seeing them play together, seeing how they could rotate different bigs at different times. Blake Buchanan, the freshman, looks ready, and he better be because he's going to be the guy they lean on. I was a little surprised we didn't see more of Jordan Miner, the transfer from Merrimack. He was the last guy off the bench, very limited role for him. But I think that this is very much going to be a team that plays eight or nine guys every night and different eight or nine and different lineups. And I think they showed in the Tarleton win that they've got the ability to mix and match that way.
And they knocked down some shots, didn't they?
Yeah, that makes a big difference. They went 10 for 22 from three-point range. Yeah. You know, Gillespie said, hey, they were able to drive and penetrate on his defense and kick. And he said, you know, they're two good shooters to leave open. When guys are open, Isaac McNeely, Jake Groves, Ryan Dunn feels better about his shot this year. You can't leave those guys open. So it all started with the paint touches. But yeah, David, different team if they're able to. And they did that, remember, in stretches last year out in Vegas. And you know, where they had those stretches where they were just kind of bombing from three.
Mike, what were your impressions of Leon Bond?
So I really like Leon Bond. I loved him in the blue-white scrimmage. I thought he was more versatile, David, in this game than I anticipated. You know, we saw him, great athleticism in the blue-white scrimmage. His first two buckets in that game were, you know, reverses, baseline drive reverses. But in this game, I thought he showed some good versatility. I think he's going to be an emerging piece for them all year. He is, when he's on the floor, like we talked about with Beekman and Harris, when he's on the floor with Dunn, that's a lot of athleticism and length, ability to push the floor, ability to get in the passing lanes. He's still a little raw, no doubt. There were some moments in the pack where maybe he was out of position, but I think he's going to be a difference maker for them this year.
Interesting. If they get quality minutes for him, then the depth you envision absolutely could materialize.
Yeah, and I think it will. And you know, it's interesting they list Dunn as a guard, but you know, Dunn and Bond to me are those wing in the mold of and again, this was a great player. I don't know, Dre Hunter, right? Played that way. Trey Murphy played that way. And I think that Dunn and Bond can both play that way. And again, it's going to be a fascinating challenge in a good way for Tony Bennett and his staff of, okay, you love it when Harris and Beekman are together, but you also love it when Bond and Dunn are together. If you got all those guys out there, is Buchanan okay to be the next one? You love what Groves does, stretching. You love Rohde on and off the ball. Andrew Rohde, the transfer, I was a little surprised he was in the starting lineup. He played 26 minutes. He knocked down a couple of threes. He did some nice things possessing the basketball. So it's going to be really interesting to see. And we've seen this from Tony Bennett over his 15 years, right? We care who's in the starting lineup. He does not. We think a guy is benched if he doesn't start. That's not how Bennett looks at it, right? Some games are better. Some games are Jack Salt games. Some games aren't. Remember Jay Huff was like the ultimate. He'd disappear for 2 weeks. And it was, oh, he's in Tony Bennett's doghouse. Or, oh, he's going to transfer. And then they'd go play Duke. And all of a sudden, it was a good matchup for Huff. And he'd score 12 points and have 8 boards and 107,000 blocked shots in a game. And then he might disappear again for a while. And that is a thing about Tony Bennett, maybe more than any coach in the country, is he's got the ability to mix and match his lineups and guys not lose interest and not pout and not jump in the portal. You know, he says, hey, their turn is coming, and it's not lip service, and he's not trying to keep them in the fold. He's going to play the matchup in the lineup that works, and it's going to be really interesting to watch that all season, David.
It will. Mike, there's a part of me, maybe a big part of me, that thinks they're going to be better than last season, but that it won't necessarily translate to the ACC standings, because I think the conference is much better than a year ago. I think Duke and Miami are clearly the class of the league, and maybe Carolina in third, but I'd be surprised if Virginia is the top seed at the ACC tournament or sharing the regular season title like it did a year ago. But I wouldn't be surprised if it's a second weekend team in the NCAA tournament. That's how skilled the roster seems to be.
I 100% agree. I think it is a roster and a team that's going to get better as the year goes. And that's not one of those. Sometimes we say that, you know, you're playing a bunch of freshmen and you're not very good at the beginning, but you'll get better. This is a team that's pretty good right now, but has a chance to become great over the course of the year, has a chance to be really good going into March. I don't think this is as talented a team as we've maybe seen at Virginia in recent years. And I could be proven wrong. Certainly the upside on some of these guys, we just talked about Bond, like the upside on him is huge. I don't think it's as talented a team. And I think it, position by position, I don't think they upgraded from a year ago. But I think these pieces fit together better. Some of the things we just said, plus the idea of Jake Grove as that stretch four, but guys defensively, whether it's Blake Buchanan or if Miner gets going, who can help defensively and kind of take some pressure off him. I just think this is a very well-conceived roster that will, one, get better as the year goes, two, is very versatile matchup-wise, and three, just has pieces that seem to go together. So maybe you're not a perfect player, but you're a perfect player with the other four guys that can be on the floor with you. I have very high hopes for Virginia this season.
Well, I think the coaching staff is right there with you. I think they like this squad, and I think we'll learn a lot more when we see them Friday in Charlotte, and you'll learn a lot more when you go down to Florida for that MTE later this month.
Yeah, there's some interesting early season matchups, interesting non-conference matchups in general for Virginia when you think about Wisconsin and whoever the second game ends up being down there, either SMU or West Virginia. They go to Memphis, which is an intriguing kind of team this year. So, again, a team that's going to get
better.
Don't
forget about Buzz, Mike. You got Buzz, your boys coming home to Virginia.
I think I've mentally blocked out the reunion with Buzz, but that is a big time game, and that is a big time team, and what Buzz is doing there. That's going to be a fun week to get into all that. But the openers were basically lackluster, right? They were gimme games. Most teams schedule that. But if your nephew happens to coach a team, maybe you agree, hey, we'll play those guys in our opener. I'm talking about Michigan State and Tom Izzo. Tom Izzo's nephew is an assistant coach at James Madison. It's one of the big reasons that Michigan State agreed to open with JMU. Michigan State, number 4 in the preseason poll. And David, in case JMU fans weren't having enough fun this fall, they went and beat number 4 Michigan State on the road in overtime.
But Mike, so many striking things about the game, not only that Izzo's nephew is an assistant to Mark Byington, but number one, JMU's a Sun Belt preseason fave for a reason. Byington's got some players now. He's got some dudes. And his dudes played really well. Edwards, which you figured TJ Bickerstaff, the transfer from Boston College. But then how about a cat who hadn't scored the whole night? Raekwon Horton knocks down the dagger three in overtime. You know, those are the moments in upsets that are so cool. The guy who's only taken his second shot of the game, and he's like, Breslin Center? What's that? Oh, who cares? Izzo's never lost a home game in November. Oh, who cares? And he knocks it down. And oh, by the way, they caught a break because Michigan State, no typo, went 1 for 20 beyond the arc.
Yeah.
Say that again.
Yeah.
One for 20. I'm not a math major, but we both know that's 5%.
I was just trying to do the math, so I'm glad you did it for me. David, and you and I watched at least the second half of that. I put it on essentially as background noise while I was writing, I think it was my UVA basketball story, and then started to notice where we were and started to tune out the basketball story and tune in the game. I thought a lot of those threes were contested too. I thought mm-hmm. JMU played very well. So while that stat is striking and certainly a huge difference maker, don't want to make it sound like JMU wasn't playing any defense and Michigan State was. JMU did a nice job of getting out on a lot of those shots. You know, it was one of those games where if you take the names off the jerseys, I would have said, okay, that's a high level, maybe Big Ten conference game. There was nothing about that game that told me JMU should be a massive underdog in it. And I think that speaks to the potential that JMU has. You mentioned being preseason favorites, the potential they have to have a really great year.
Yeah. And much like, we talked about Virginia and Virginia Tech, we're going to learn more about them on Friday when they step up in competition. Now, JMU's not stepping up in competition, but tomorrow night, they play at Kent State. And Kent State is among the favorites in the Mid-American Conference. And that will be, you know, they won 28 games last year, defending MAC champions. I'm sitting here looking at their KenPom from last year. And lost to Indiana in the first round of the NCAA tournament. So that's, you know, how do you move on from what is arguably, what is certainly among the top five wins in program history, and then just a couple nights later, on the road against a quality opponent, how do you perform? I think that's going to be really interesting.
Yeah, I love the fact that they're testing themselves this much before conference play. And as I've had a bunch of people point out to me in the last 2 days, that does go on their NCAA, their postseason resume, because that is a JMU team that is allowed to compete in the postseason.
Yeah. So about that.
Which brings us to the next topic, which, David, you've been all over this story. JMU continues to be undefeated, continues to be one of the biggest stories in college football.
Yes.
Because, in part, they're not allowed to compete in the postseason. David, catch us up with the latest in the Duke's fight to try to change that.
Long story short, Mike, JMU is not going into the dark night quietly. And I'll tell you what, nor would I if I was Jeff Bourne, the athletic director, or I was the administration there in Harrisonburg. And they are taking a cue from North Carolina in the Tez Walker situation. They are trying to make this a PR battle. And they certainly have public opinion on their side. And what they have done is Jeff Bourne and the administration wrote a letter to the chairman of the Division I Board of Directors, who is the president at the University of Georgia. And they are pleading their case yet again. And people might say, well, how is this different from back in April when you appealed and you were turned down? Well, Mike, April was spring ball. It's now November. And they're 9-0. And they are playing excellent football. They are, by any measure, beyond prepared for FBS membership. This 2-year transition that the NCAA and the spirit of the rule is not bad. They don't want institutions upgrading to FBS just on a whim without having put in place the infrastructure and the resources to compete. And so for 2 years, you've got to prove yourself. Well, JMU proved itself last year by going 8-3, and now they're 9-0. They belong in postseason. They should be allowed to play in the Sun Belt Championship game. All that being said, my hunch is that this will fall on deaf ears in the NCAA bureaucracy, and JMU's best hope, and it's not, you know, it's probably a coin flip at this point as to whether enough teams hit that 6-6 benchmark to fill all 41 bowls, in which case JMU would get a call. And in which case, wouldn't it be awesome to have JMU play Liberty in a bowl? I mean, it would be great. And it could be 12-0 versus 13-0, because Liberty would have played the Conference USA championship game.
That's cool, because those fan bases don't like each other, interstate rivals, all of that. Wouldn't it be cooler if undefeated JMU was the highest ranked group of five conference champion?
It would be, I'll tell you what would also be cool, if we had any idea how the CFP selection committee views the Dukes.
Yep.
But since they are ineligible, they give them, the committee gives itself an easy out and says, we're not even going to evaluate them. Well, of course you're not, because you don't want to make the NCAA look bad. You don't want to make the Sun Belt look bad for not allowing them in the conference championship game. You know, Virginia's sitting there one spot below Tulane in the polls. Dukes are 21, Tulane is 20. That would be JMU's primary competition for that group of five spot in a New Year's Six game. And frankly, Tulane has a much harder road ahead. I mean, they've got a season end or a regular season finale against Texas San Antonio, which is also undefeated in the AAC. And, you know, would anyone be surprised if Texas San Antonio beat Tulane? I don't think so. But Texas San Antonio lost three non-conference games. Yep. So they're not going to be the highest ranked champion. Now, maybe it would end up being Air Force despite its loss to Army, or Fresno out of the Mountain West. But man, if JMU was sitting there at 13-0, it would have one hell of a case for inclusion in a New Year's Six game.
Yeah, I think like you, I want it to happen. Don't expect it to happen. That's kind of where I am with this. Here's the thing that chaps my backside about this whole story is, a few years ago, we wrote about all this with Bellarmine basketball. Mm-hmm. And at that point, the A-Sun put together a proposal to change the rule. And at the crux of their proposal was the fact that it's not a good rule. It was a good rule back when they put it in place, because teams could move up to Division I without being in a conference, which meant that nobody's really overseeing your academics. Nobody's overseeing your facilities. There is no standard you're being held to as you make that transition. It made sense to say, look, don't worry about winning, losing at this point, because we're not letting you compete. You need to get all your infrastructure settled. And then we'll say, okay, you're ready. That made sense. Now you can't move up unless you're in a conference. JMU is in a conference. The Sun Belt has standards. It has standards for the field, for the turf, for your attendance, for all of those things. So there is no functional reason for this rule. Bellarmine basketball got screwed by it. Merrimack basketball got screwed by it. JMU football is about to get screwed by it. And there's no reason that in all of this screwing, they haven't fixed it in an off season. Do I think you can change it now? It feels a little weird, right? We're nine games in. Feels a little weird to now be like, oh yeah, we've been wrong this whole time. Now, they did it with Tez Walker, although they said, you know, new information, whatever. But it just feels unlikely that they'll change it now. I'm furious that we're having this conversation. This should have been dealt with in the offseason.
Agreed. And what is the catchphrase among administrators? Student athlete welfare. Well, how does this advance student athlete welfare? Don't you think these student athletes A, want to compete, and B, deserve to compete. And Jeff Bourne made that quite clear yesterday when he met with some of us on a video conference.
There's no good argument at this point to keep them out other than this is the rule. They knew what the rule was.
Mm-hmm. Which they did, and they concede that.
100%. And if that's what the NCAA wants to kind of go down on, you can't really shake that position. But it's what you just said that is the larger point to me. If you're the NCAA, why are you sticking to your guns on this? Why are you enforced? What is it? Show me the benefit. And it would totally change my opinion on this. Show me the benefit of, show me why it would be harmful. It would be negative to make a JMU team eligible at this point with what they've done on the field in 2 years, with the fact that they're in a conference that has academic standards and facility standards and all of that. Show me the benefit to making them ineligible. And I would totally then give up this topic. Like, hey, we're 9 games in. They've got a reason for it. Okay. But if your reason is, well, we said it and we're sticking to it, it feels kind of like the stupid fight I have with my son at dinner time, where I say, you have to eat your green beans for you to get dessert. And then he eats everything else on his plate, but he doesn't eat the green beans. And my wife's like, really? You can't have dessert? And I'm like, well, I said it. I kind of got to stick to it. I'm probably wrong. And the NCAA is definitely wrong.
And Mike, just think of the goodwill that the NCAA could foster by doing this. And couldn't the NCAA use a little goodwill these days as it grovels before Congress for help with all its antitrust issues and employee-employer relationships and all that? And yet, here it's presented to you on a plate. It is a golden opportunity for you to do the right thing, and you're not going to do it? It is. It's baffling. It's frustrating. I can't imagine what it's like for the young men in the program. JMU thinks and hopes that it will know something within a week. Let's hope that we are both pleasantly surprised by the outcome. Hey, Mike, before we close out, I have to ask you one more question. Did Tyler from Spartanburg get a game ball after Clemson beat Notre Dame?
I think Tyler from Spartanburg got a big I told you so, not a game ball. But how about that? And for maybe, I don't know, salvaging your season maybe too much, but what a win for Clemson over Notre Dame and for Dabo to, at least for a week maybe, silence those critics.
Yeah, no, there is a cynical side, Mike, that tells me that old Tyler was a plant and that it was all a ruse to get Dabo fired up, let him go off, get his team fired up before that big home game against Notre Dame. And if it was, it was one of the great ideas of all time, because Clemson sure did play its backside off against the Irish.
Yeah, I hope somewhere Tyler from Spartanburg is having a beer with Coach Stallions from Michigan and all the other oddball characters
yes.
of this college football season.
Right?
I picture it like the dog sitting around playing poker in that painting. All of these oddball characters that, hey, right, we had a Hollywood writer strike, so maybe the people writing this year's script, maybe they're not what we're used to.
Nope, very true.
But it is a lot of fun. Well, we hope this has been fun for you. Thanks for listening. You can subscribe to Teal and Barber on Apple Podcasts or wherever you find your favorite pods. And please consider supporting local journalism with an online subscription to the Richmond Times-Dispatch. You can find a special promotional offer available at richmond.com. Today's show was produced by Dean Hoffmeyer and yours truly. For David Teal, I'm Mike Barber. Thanks for listening. Be healthy and safe. And please join David and me again next week.